You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 5th of July, 2023. As always, my site, theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com, is where you can donate to me and contact me, whatever you need. And, of course, my Patreon page is extremely important. But today, I'm going to spend this hour talking about the Byzantine economy, or I should say, the political thought that animated the economy of the Byzantine Empire. One of the reasons I do this is because it's a section that's normally left out of a lot of the works on usury, and the critical works on capitalism in the West, especially from a Catholic point of view. And it is a completely separate field of study. There's plenty of moral convictions in common, but it's two different universes in terms of how it was carried out. So while you don't really have a systematic treatment of it in Byzantium, of course the Church Fathers came as close as you can get. Their regular condemnations of usury, the always shifting definitions of the term, what that has to do with labor and production. But as far as economics as a separate field, that's a different matter. Byzantium was, to be very general about it, a Platonic empire. Plato spoke of plutocracy and oligarchy, as did Aristotle. Plato saw economic life as something that's subject to decay, but that decay is a moral one. In a competitive system, an oligarchy will always take over and then oppress those who are unable to compete in the chaos of the market. What wins, of course, isn't intelligence, but deviousness and a total lack of moral scruple. Those that fail fall into debt, creating a as a proletarian subsistence class, that soon is taken as the norm. Inequality, especially in the extreme cases of oligarchy, is what leads to usury and speculation, because usury really is the only mechanism for the poor to stay afloat. But an oligarchy refers to a ruling class that functions solely by the fact that they have access to wealth and nothing else, which means that it empowers those that are extremely devious and amoral, those without a conscience. It empowers sociopaths. But the greed of such a ruling class, where money takes the place of everything, is a result of this unbounded economic freedom. An economic freedom that in market societies say you could use your property any way you please, which means that capital is what I really mean by property. It's merely the occasion to enrich oneself. And when you use this cash and loan it at interest without any reference to what's being produced by it, especially when you loan solely for people to be able to function at all, it ends up leading to the total expropriation of goods that have been mortgaged, which ends up meaning everything that's productive. So this freedom brings ruin, and it empowers those who crave luxury, not just in the ruling class, but the ordinary people who crave this and spend irrationally and will very soon fall into the hands of their creditors. One of the great things that E. Michael Jones and Michael Hoffman have dealt with in terms of usury is It's not merely charging interest on a loan. It's the entire context where that's possible, where that becomes a necessity, and what happens afterwards. And there's been so much ink spilled on Lorenzo de' Medici, who was a contemporary of the very end of the Byzantine Empire, and was a revolutionary in the same sense that the Phoenicians were, that ruling class was, at Tyre. Capitalism has always existed, not necessarily in its, obviously, its postmodern form, but the so-called economic freedom, the freedom of contract and negotiation, which is always a freedom of unequals. And one of the things that led to the collapse of the Byzantine Empire, middle of the 15th century, is that the Italian city-states, especially Venice, took over Byzantine trade. So the Medici's become very important in Byzantine life. And as most of us know, as I've said 100 times, the oligarchs who ruled in Venice and Florence wanted to disguise their rule using frontmen, the spectacles that the Roman Empire used to use, especially the Republic, the Breton circuses, is designed to cover over economic misery and create a solidarity that wouldn't exist otherwise. And one of my favorite phrases from Baron Medal is that in Rome, these spectacles were called Breton circuses. In Florence, they were called the Renaissance. And the great German economist Heinrich Pesch, he's talking about both Rome and Florence, and hence what took over the late Byzantine Empire. He says, free enterprise and slavery and the moneyed oligarchy and pauperism, which stemmed from it all, had shaken ancient society to its foundations. The attempt was made to stem the threatening collapse by cheap food and amusement for the exploited masses of the people. What more was there to do? For the moral force that was indispensable for moral reform was lacking in the pagan world. So, but something happened. And this is one of the key economic events of all time. Something happened in the midst of the Roman Empire. The rise of the church and then the Christian Empire, East and West, altered the terminology and the ideology of economic life, and the assumptions. The edicts of Constantine and Theodosius introduced a brand new element. And it was the Christian concept of the soul, and hence the worth of the person, and by extension, the worth of his labor. So while that's happening, usury is also being condemned. The Church Fathers, as you know, spent a lot of time on that topic and the economic problems that surround it. But this mentality started a new era. The big monasteries, the emperor himself, became an organizing principle of society. What we would call slaves or serfs had their status changed pretty wildly. They weren't property anymore. Slave families, for example, in the new empire, couldn't be sold off. Families couldn't be broken up. And serfdom, ultimately, is that farmers are tied to the land. Neither their labor nor the land itself is seen as a commodity anymore. And it can't be speculated on, as what you saw in the beginning of the Reformation, and certainly can't be traded arbitrarily from place to place. The land was guaranteed. And given that, it was no longer an object of speculation. So the land grabs of the early Reformation, which came from the Renaissance, the first real big land market in many centuries was found. But even slaves now, in the early years of the empire, had a homeland. And of course, all economic development, East and West, but especially in the East, because it was so politically unified for such a long time, all production took place under the shield of the canons in Christian principle. When you have this revolutionary concept that says both lords and serfs are the same in the sense that they're both children of God and will be judged according to the same standard, the very elevation of the slave meant an elevation in the labor that he does. Society, not just the individual, was seen to have a soul, and that's the principle of unity that will eventually resolve itself into the idea of the nation. This unity isn't physical. I mean, it has physical components, but it's a moral unity. Why is economics a separate field? In fact, why are all the social sciences separate from one another? It's not a separate field. It is a separate field now because it's been separated from practical reason. Another word for, you know, ethics and ethical theory. It became a field in itself only when it was removed from moral laws. Then it has some kind of autonomy. And that goes for everything from psychology to sociology. Christ's establishment of his church and hence the empire, modeled on the Old Testament version, created a unity in thought and will, intelligence, and how we view ideas, the freedom of actions and moral obligations, all were unified. You know, I make a big deal about the distinction between power and authority. Really, power is something that came strictly from Machiavelli and Hobbes. It's the ability to coerce somebody, but without any moral obligation attached to it. Authority is a different story. And authority comes from this very soul of a society, and it applies only in a moral sense. Power, abstractly, exists because its connection with moral obligation has been removed. Many of you know I've said this. You know, if there's this new principle of unity as part of a cosmos designed by God, then any human action became very significant to the point unknown in the ancient world, which also means productive labor. Whether you were a free worker or not, you were still considered an object. But then that changed into being the subject and even the goal of economic and political life. It was a revolutionary concept, because it comes under the law of the person who rules and who created the cosmos. His sovereignty exists because he is a creator, which puts him ontologically in a very different category. Let me continue quoting Pasteur. How the oppressed and impoverished of the time greeted such a message as their gospel. Humanity was to be reconstructed morally. The oppressive worldly appetite was to be exchanged for the uplifting of moral will and freedom. Self-seeking, the quest for dominion, love, and the reciprocal willingness to serve. Horrible exploitation for mercy and benevolent slavery and the degradation of man for an esteem of the human person. The unrestrained sexual appetite for chastity and incontinence. The contempt for work and a high regard for it. From now on, property ownership was rated as a gift provided by God with man, established not as absolute master, but merely as an administrator. And in fact, not only for his own enjoyment, but also for assisting others in need and putting the love of man into action. So he's contrasting the old versus the new. Now, of course, it's the old versus the new in the opposite relation. All of this has been jettisoned since the beginning of the Reformation. Another way of putting this is that it took the Roman Empire from its bondage to market dependency. The monastics, were both East and West, were essential to this. It restructured social life in accord with its actual true nature. It's a part of the created order. And the family and the individuals within it regained their initial dignity. The inquisitive individualism was overthrown. And the state fostered this in the pagan world. It wasn't an anthill anymore. The strong didn't have a right to rule the weak. But the empire tried to create two natural forms and integrate them together. That is, the family on the one hand and the state on the other, creating an organic unity out of it where mutual collaboration or solidarity became the norm. And this was the role of the Council of Chalcedon in 491, where the unity of divine and human, including economic and statecraft, was unified voluntarily in one person, because they both had to have a will, which means that it was a voluntary association, not a forcible submission. The ancient world was a forceful one. Applied from the top down, the Christian world was very different. It was based upon the natural order. All of the great heresies that rocked the Byzantine Empire in its first 1,000 years of existence all separated the political power from the moral. That's why Chalcedon was so immensely significant, because this was a link that could not be dissolved except through the revolution of the Reformation, the beginning of the modern world. oligarchs will promote a system of free market capitalism so long as they could benefit from it. But in the pagan world, a slave family could be broken down. It could be sold for parts, so to speak. But that system did collapse. The empire was rooted in nature itself. It was based on the family. And the emperor, of course, was the father. This unity, this organic unity, is the basis of reciprocal rights and obligations connected to time and place, but of course it also had its universal significance. This was a basis of all aspects of human life. The family is its primal unity. Civil society predates the individual, as is obviously the case. Cooperation, intrinsic to family and national life, is promoted over the manipulation of conflict among individuals. This is what led to the stability of the Byzantine Empire, and this stability will lead to greater productivity. The Byzantine currency and prices in the Eastern Empire remained static for 1,000 years. Of course, the very act of this stability requires settlement. The establishment of a home is what creates culture, and that creates the homeland, and this homeland has both a clear identity and, of course, a father figure. The hunter-gatherers are not necessarily to be envied. Those groups, except as eccentricities to the few that exist today, they're largely forgotten to history. They're not capable of communicating with the outside world. They become insignificant. But home life is a creator of culture, and culture then creates the broader civilization. So, the battle against this acquisitive individualism and the organic family as the root of everything has three components in terms of its ideological foundation. The first is that the state is a necessary aspect of social life, and social life, in fact, predates the individual. That's why the state of nature was such a revolutionary and very bizarre thought experiment. And this is based on natural law and not something like the invisible hand or the capricious actions of individuals, which all just work out. The second thing is that the constitution, the state, in the broad sense, is connected with moral obligation. And finally, the state derives from the family. Solidarity and the spiritual core is what protects its members. The opposite of that would be the mechanical, egocentric conception of society that you find in Thomas Hobbes. As far as Byzantium proper is concerned, other than your regular attacks on usury, St. John Chrysostom and Gregory of Nyssa, there's so many. When you study Byzantine economic theory, though, you have to go to a bunch of different sources. The Church Fathers are, of course, the main one. And imperial legislation, even juridical decisions, not just in the Eastern Rome, but Western Rome, too. Even monastic practice and charters. Ancient Roman law, that which includes, you know, ancient Greece. The patristic writings and, not to be forgotten, the Old Testament prophets, who wrote a lot on economic questions. This is the foundation of kind of coming to understand what the Byzantine world was, economically speaking. It's simple to say that there's this rejection of worldly power and hence worldly wealth, especially when you consider it as a primary motivation, and of course all the power and political power it can buy. This was a constant theme both in monastic writings as well as in the Old Testament. Gifts and charity were given economic status. Since this is much of an exchange as anything else, it's left out of modern ideas of what exchange is. Now, there was this entry of economic rationality, so to speak, of the modern era, which did filter through the Italian city-states, but is not a patrimony of the Byzantine Empire. There's nothing natural about the systems of North Italy, but it comes from this unfortunate lust for gold and status, which will eventually destroy them all. Of course, agriculture is the connection of the home and natural law. And in the patristic mind, it's the wholesome life. And the peasant community was always at war with landowners. And landowners, without the moral law, tend to exploit the peasantry and even engage in usury themselves. Zane Basel says that, you know, the farming life is at the mercy, you know, it's still not stable in the sense it's the mercy, it's the weather, fortune, general uncertainty. In other words, nothing is really certain. But that's to be found in the activity in the material realm anywhere. Anything could happen to a wealthy man. St. John Chrysostom talks about the constant worry over lawsuits, military defeat, economic downturn that could wipe him out tomorrow. Why he concludes that those people are never really quite happy. The stress on the virtues is at the core of any economic thinking at the time. And one of the main ones, and naturalists have taken over this concept the last few hundred years, is autarky or self-sufficiency, which implies a certain ascetic people and the rejection of the pursuit of wealth for its own sake. Now, autarky tends to be misunderstood. I did a whole show on Fichte's closed commercial state. And of course, that's an extreme example. But self-sufficiency is a great virtue at all levels. It does rest on self-denial and solidarity. And you see it everywhere. So, needing nothing is both to be independent as well as to be at peace. The market leads to stress, it leads to instability and dependency. I mean, they're occasionally useful and they're occasionally needed, and this could never be ignored. But to simply expand your land holdings, for example, during the days of the empire, it would be an irrational pursuit, no different than aggressive conquests would be. Because it always leads to conflict and dispossession. Aristocracy itself was a part of this autarky, since that class earned its place either by military or bureaucratic service. Wealth may be a part of this, but this is only a secondary concern. Aristocracy is not oligarchy. The emperor, for his part, one of his main duties was to safeguard the borders of the empire. And if territories had been lost, to regain them, especially if they had Christians living on it. The writings of Leo VI, the emperor, a just war really is a defensive one, which is not a big surprise. But these bellicose wars of conquest derive from the same passion as the lust for wealth. And in the pagan Roman Empire, it was one and the same thing. They went together. But you have Byzantine histories, such as Aretas, and his discussion of Alexander of the Great. He's talking about his conquests not as such, but as a desire, a virtuous desire, to take what truly belonged to us, what had previously belonged to the empire of the Romans, he says. If territory was populated by Orthodox people, and at one time part of the Roman state, a war to retake it was not a problem at all. The intention, the motive force of the ruler was paramount, and therefore his virtue was extremely important. And you see it all over the place. The goal is the peace and prosperity of the Roman state, which precludes aggressive warfare and this kind of acquisitiveness. Yes, conquest brought in more wealth and slaves, as was the case in ancient Rome, but that wasn't the foundation of warfare. So the analog to this, of course, the integrity of the productive unit and self-sufficiency, the autarky that safeguards it, and therefore no injustice economically can be done to anyone else. The middle Byzantine idea, which Angeliki Leo and many others talk about, the era of the Macedonians, this is my favorite, of course, the great Basil II, one of the greatest monarchs who ever lived, who had as his core idea, possessions of all subjects, especially the weaker ones, should be safeguarded. That the encroachments on rights and possessions of others is usually done by this oligarchic caste. Now, there's nothing path-breaking here, but this was the foundation of the empire, whether or not an emperor could enforce it. The concept of autarky was a major political and economic virtue. The very structure of instability and insecurity comes from this belief that you deserve more. So military aggression, colonial rule, that would be comparable to pleonexia in the economic sphere, the love of gold, the love of money. Economics was just a part of the political and theological world. Anyway, Philagria, love of silver, love of money. Same kind of thing. The political analog would be wars of conquest. Now, there have been, just like the Domostroy in Imperial Russia, you have the Strategikon of Kekiumenos in the 11th century. This is the concept of estate management. It's a microeconomic text, and it shows what a good management of the household was supposed to be. Remember, a household was a small state. It even had its own little emperor and had a division of labor. It wasn't a nuclear family. It was extended. It includes servants and dependents and anyone else. But the mark of good management comes from, and I'm quoting here, an abundance of wheat, wine, and everything else, seed and livestock, edible and movable, trees of all kinds, reed beds, really so that you can have a return without having a yearly worry. And that last clause is the critical one, since the purpose of autarky is peace. Diversification, he speaks of at length, the hedge against bad fortune that could occur at any time, especially where markets are concerned. If the head of the family seeks gold and power above independence, those two things normally are mutually exclusive, it won't be long before he either becomes an oligarch himself or a slave of the usurers, and then a dependent on those in the market who are more powerful than he is. Which is another way of saying the patrimony which has been built up by many generations before you will go into the hands of aliens for the sake of your short-term desires. So autarky is connected to the maintenance of basic necessities and therefore the increase in mental peace. It's only after these have been reasonably guaranteed that anything else can happen economically. Any dependence on the market was a bad thing, since markets were just as uncertain as the weather was. Markets always exist, but only as a last resort, not the first. Autarky is compatible with markets, but certainly not a dependency on them. There's certainly nothing wrong with having a certain connection to a market when there are no other options available. That's kind of the purpose of markets. It's to obtain that which you can't obtain yourself. You can't create yourself, or even a community can't create itself. It's not only consistent with self-sufficiency, but it's a requirement for it. It depends on the unit you're talking about. Autarky depends on many factors, totally outside of the control of the society. Markets have an important place. And even the merchant, who at his worst is a usurer, but at his best is the transporter and insurer and protector of goods moving from one place to the next. That's where it's not profit, that's the wage that he gains. But profit is too broad of a word, because it has to be situated within social life. But any surplus gained through labor was inherently legitimate. But even that was dependent on its purpose. You can never discourage investment. It can't be the profit motive for its own sake, or to buy the courts or something like that. That's why this is a moral question. Without surplus value, nothing could ever be built or maintained. It's necessary for any civilization to exist at all. That is not contradictory to Christianity, the empire, or self-sufficiency, or anything like that. In Byzantium itself, the land wasn't the greatest. Therefore, diversity, the diversifying agriculture, was very important. A lot of marketable crops, and the peasant was usually brought to the marketplace. That wasn't a matter of dependency. If anything, it enhanced his ability to remain independent. When you have such a stable empire for such a long period of time, none of this is utopian. The aristocracy, without a strong emperor to keep them in check, funded land clearances, urban real estate, the employment of skilled labor and trade. But that's not interesting. I mean, any society needs that to function. When profiteering leads to rent-seeking and usury, which is way beyond what anyone could possibly need, you have so much of it you have to lend it out, that's when the moral issue becomes a severe one. Debt is the opposite of independence. Nikephoros II in 964 issued a novel on monastic property. This most pious of emperors encouraged what became a central aspect of Monasticism, productive enterprise and productive investments to take place on their lands. That's a huge part of the monastic life. Labor is always a part of it and doesn't have a relation to profit-seeking, especially since no one monk can control any of it. Ultimately, it's in the hands of the bishop. That is not a counterexample to autarky or self-sufficiency, since this is one of the many ways that civilization sustains itself. Profit comes from labor, not in the sense of the modern self-seeking behavior, which at the time, later in Byzantium, existed only among the Jews and the North Italians. But investments in everything from charity to building public works was essential to life. You have to have surplus value for that to happen. That's not profit in the modern sense. Any self-sufficiency requires surplus value. Self-sufficiency isn't the opposite of profit, but the seeking of rents is a different story. Usury is essentially just a manifestation of rent seeking. The price is based not just on whatever it is you're selling, but also your political or social position. You parlay that into, having to be paid off. But trading for the basic needs of the community is part of autarky in many respects, especially in a place like Greece. There's no rejection of profit, but the money has to be a secondary motive. But a tremendous profit over time has the danger of destroying the community, which in the Old Testament causes heresy, the abandonment of Yahweh in exchange for the pagan gods that they have to maintain in the temple in order to trade and have diplomatic relations with other states, the capturing of state power in the courts. This is the danger. This is why the prophets were so important. But this kind of profiteering becomes the norm. It leads to oligarchy and then moneylending because society becomes that much more stratified. That automatically creates massive debts. There's always going to be losers in this game, even among elite people. But as society gets less and less equal, and this was another big concern of the prophets, the poor require credit to function. One of the roles of the emperor was to ensure that this never occur, at least not systematically, on the simple grounds that a radically stratified society would destroy itself. The Greek term autourgia refers to assets that generate profits. This is another word for sort of another word for capital. The only thing that extracts value out of it is labor. And of course, Byzantium accepted the labor theory of value and wealth, as any common sense person can do. It's the only thing that makes sense. Because even supply and demand have to have something to supply and demand. Autourgia refers to labor in that it requires it and nothing else to produce surplus value. That's the opposite of usury. It's not quite synonymous with capital, but it refers to everything from land to mills and what we would normally call productive capital. Profit is seen as a social, never an individual category, and was pursued for specific ends, not for its own purposes. Without the common good, profit is illegitimate just by definition. But a profitable enterprise was a protected asset, as far as the Byzantine community was concerned. And none of this has anything to do with autarky. Markets, of course, were integral, necessary for self-sufficiency, not necessarily global markets, but certainly local ones. Self-sufficiency wasn't about an individual or even a family, but all social groups from the empire down, and certainly the empire and the nation. Profit is not usury. Those are completely different categories. This has nothing to do with surplus value, but it is what they claim to be a natural increase of a metal, such as gold and silver, and is really founded on power. The preconditions of usury are mass poverty, where small farmers need loans to maintain solvent. In ancient Rome, the end of the Punic Wars, the small farmer disappeared. Now you do have some legitimate claims to so-called interest in Byzantium. regulated by law, which was never compounded, but that had more to do with being a partner than having the money itself increase. But profit in the sense of a surplus value was a requirement of labor. Now, the merchant at his worst doesn't produce anything of his own. He's merely a middleman. He skims from the top. He's a manipulator. Because the point is to attempt to manipulate someone that they need something when in fact they don't. The worst type of this was the banker, the moneylender that uses his own wealth to charge interest on others. But in a circumstance of already existing inequality and poverty, we're not talking about the merchantry at their best, which is about transportation and protection. But that was very tightly regulated. St. Simeon the New Theologian, in his letter on Ephesians 5, you know, the 16, where it says, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Even there, you know, he has a story in here about, essentially, he references the problems that accrue to the careless merchant who will not take care of his enterprise. And then Simeon Metaphrastes, and in his writing on St. Spyridon of Trimethius. And there, coming from St. Simeon, the story is of a sea captain that borrowed money from the saint, in fact, that he didn't want to pay back. Now, the sea captain at the time only really had two roles. Either he transported goods, or he was in the navy. So this hapless captain uses all manner of trickery to avoid repayment, but at some point comes to repentance. He admits the cause of why he doesn't want to pay. Now, Spyridon, Simeon Metaphrastes, the moral claim is that because the captain failed to properly invest the money he received, he now can't pay it back. Now, of course, as you know, the parable of the talents, everything coming from the New Testament. Of course, it makes sense that the proper investment would have been to invest in his own assets so that he can continue a stable living as a captain, the transporter, the protector of valuable goods. What this guy spent the money on was essentially luxury, especially when you spend it on luxuries or gambling, when it was meant to, was given to you to make your own capital more reliable. Now, certainly that's not profit in any modern sense, but it's a requirement. And Spyridon eventually forgives him and then makes an economic speech saying that these actions are irrational and destructive, not to mention wasteful. Now, profitability of the day meant a lot more and was far deeper than it is today, because there's no such thing as the modern abstraction of the individual. It was certainly not a moral category. So these stories, whether it be St. Simeon the New Theologian in Ephesians 5, and he, you know, St. Simeon does talk about the need for merchants. But that man is only tolerated if he keeps his profit in line with the risk that he takes, and offers usable labor, like safe transport, not merely the buying and selling of things. You could be worried about many things in transportation. But if he abides by the law of justice, his rewards will be great. Only that risks are connected to the surplus that he has earned, he should be compensated for that. None of this has anything to do with autarky, but these are semi-economic stories that really have a spiritual meaning. But it does express the basic Byzantine view, early to mid-Byzantine view, of what economics is, what profit is, what money is, what the merchant is. We're not talking about usury here. Trade, and hence money, and the money earned from it, these are necessities. They have no bearing on profit in the modern capitalist sense, and they're certainly not mutually exclusive. There's a few authors, including those I like, who confuse profit with usury. Liu and so many other writers who I admire have a tough time making the distinction between money deriving from usury and profit from labor. Of course, the church always condemned usury and any rent-seeking type of behavior. Usury is unclean, but profit, so long as it's connected to labor for the good of the whole, is not only clean, but a necessity and a praiseworthy one. You know, the Byzantines believed that the merchant's profit was justified and legitimate. You know, she's writing like this is a big discovery, but she's confusing categories here. And the profit, so-called, that comes from usury, has nothing to do with the profit coming from labor. In fact, they're opposites. The usurer wants to make money by doing nothing. They're not in the same category in any way, let alone the moral way. Now, the only thing lower than seeking money for its own sake is, of course, rent-seeking and usury. And that's because it's not productive and is generally egocentric. Now, receiving money for the same amount of money for the successful completion of a socially necessary task, that's not really profit. It's just justice. No one's talking about surplus value here. And that brings us to ideas of the just value and the just price and what that has to do with profit. Of course, these are all very tightly connected. In Byzantium, it was really the monastic metristic writings that gave specific content to these concepts, not to mention the emperors and patriarchs. But the just value and just price are two different things. Just price presupposes a transaction. In a context, just value is a matter of evaluation, what it is in and of itself, without a necessary transaction being involved. And they are distinct. The just price isn't dependent on any particular process of you know, supply-demand price formation. A just price can be agreed upon by two contracting parties. It can be the marketplace, but it doesn't have to be in each case. It's a sign of moral degeneration when market price is considered the just price, no matter what. It can also be a price that's imposed by the state, a price that's regulated, though not imposed by administrative action. And all of these concepts were alive and spoken of in Byzantium at all different eras. But the one thing that they never disagreed on is that labor is the root of it all. Now, in Byzantium, as well as the later Roman Empire, laws governing exchange were predicated on the idea, of course, of free contractual negotiation. But, of course, it's never absolute. Modern states, coming from Hobbes and Locke onward, see the state solely in these terms, that the guarantor of contracts is the only reason it exists, and hence the rights of free negotiation. In law, of course, exchanges are made to sale prices established through negotiation between competent free parties, without fear, without the threat of force. But that's a huge if. Those are huge ifs. It's a huge set of circumstances. It's very difficult to achieve because usually parties are not equal to one another. Now, of course, you know, trickery, manipulation, violence, that annuls the contract in law, but not necessarily in practice. Now, fraud means, you know, disinformation regarding the items and everything else, but it goes a lot deeper than that. But even in the law of Justinian, there was the very important legal standard was enormous damage, laesio enormis, an extreme form of economic harm done to the seller if the sale price is less than half the just price. The contract would be immediately annulled unless the seller agrees to pay the just price. So clearly, you have basic legal and moral limitations on contract negotiation. And you found this everywhere in the church, East and West, and certainly in the patristic idea. And the assumption that negotiation, in the sense we think of it, necessarily involves lying. It's using verbal tricks to get someone to say something they normally wouldn't. And hence, those contracts can't be taken seriously. But the line between negotiation and manipulation is very thin. So in Byzantium and all traditional societies, the formation of the price isn't necessarily the just price. There's a price that's based on free negotiation, which could really be anything, and one that puts moral and social constraints so that this extreme damage to individuals may be avoided. So the laesio enormis presupposes the concept of just value, independent of these negotiations, and acceptance of free negotiation by the establishment of an actual price and a limitation placed on it when the sale price is under half the value of the commodity. It's another way of saying that market negotiations exist, but within strict limits. And it's more than just Lacio and Norma's. And it got even more strict when it comes to both labor contracts and land sales. And in the middle period, in and around the era of the great Basil II, but once that Macedonian dynasty weakened and fell apart, the Paleologan period saw a complete collapse of this. The strength of the emperors and the royal family was essential. So the Macedonian emperors, on land sales, for example, especially to the elite, had as one of its legal bases the protection afforded the seller by Lacio and Normus. We're also talking about what happens when you're deep in debt because of usury, and the creditor will eventually take everything you have. But Lacio and Normus was extended beyond the original and limited intent. The novel of Romanos I in 934, if the sale price of land acquired after a famine or something like that was less than half the just value, the sale was annulled, and the buyer lost the money he paid. That would include forced sales based on debt. The sale price was not quite that low, but nevertheless resulted in great harm to the seller. It was still annulled anyway, but the buyer could recover some of the money he paid. And this was extended even to laborers concerning contracts about their wages. None of that, of course, existed in North Italy or the result of the William of Orange and everything that came from in England after that. And not, of course, in today's version of the sea power drive for profit. But as far as workers are concerned, labor being the source of everything, if it was found that the negotiated and agreed upon wage was less than the just wage, the contract would be annulled and everything would be evaluated. And this is in, you know, the middle part of the Middle Ages. The Macedonians around the turn of the first millennium. Of course, freedom of negotiation is always going to be taken for granted. But we realize there's contracts, when they're engaged in by unequal parties, will lead to tremendous damage. It's not really a breakthrough idea, although to the modern, or especially the postmodern, they don't really know what I'm talking about. But the just price was essential. Now, of course, starting in the 11th, but especially the 12th century, there was a lot of attenuations to that. And this became a matter of boilerplate rather than real economic justice. Of course, the events of the 13th century, especially the Fourth Crusade, harmed the state's power. And that's another way of saying that free negotiation completely took over. The idea of justice no longer existed because it couldn't be enforced. The just value and the just price, in this case, became identical with the market price. And that was a sign of moral degeneration and the weakening of the emperor and the power of the state. Under strong emperors, of course, especially in the Macedonian house, these things could be enforced with great vigor. The just price is a big deal. You know, scholastics talk about this all the time. It is variable. It's not fixed, but it doesn't nullify it. You know, Thomas Aquinas was willing to admit that minor deviations from the just price isn't really a huge problem. But even some others, and after commas, that so long as the contract is negotiated lawfully, even morally speaking, 50% of the just price could be given one way or the other, simply as a matter of practicality. Because the just price is imprecise, again, that doesn't mean that it goes away. That's a pretext, not a reason. So if the just price is the same thing as the market price, then how can you talk about economic injustice at all? We all know what the capitalist, you know, libertarian answer to these things are. The contract is valid because both parties agreed to it. There's no context there. There's no circumstances there. And of course, the medieval mind, the East or West, says that it's the common need and the common good, not the individual, that is the measure of this value. So it's another way of saying the value of a good should be considered not necessarily out of necessity and hence demand, but what is it? What's this impact on the community? Value is based on labor, but labor itself is a social institution. No one produces everything by themselves. Of course, labor is going to influence things like cost and, you know, supply, but certainly it isn't the only, the market is certainly not the only determinant of value. So just price, just value, just wage. The simple explanation is that a just wage is that which is sufficient for a man to raise a family in relative security. That's an investment in essentially human infrastructure, if you want to put it in modern terms. If you don't pay at that level, then the reproduction of loyal workers and their families will cease to exist. Misery will be the only result. The bosses will have a temporary boost, but that's about it. So that, in the nature of consensus and tradition, in a stable economic order, is the nature of the just wage. But of course, we live in an extremely unstable time, precisely because ideas of justice and the moral order are long gone. But the modern and the postmodern idea sees markets as well as societies as mechanisms, as machines. It's a substitute for natural law or even providence. It sets the terms of exchange. It sets the limit of legal power. The Byzantine frame of reference was a moral universe. The common good came first, and only in that context could the buyer and seller begin to negotiate. And it doesn't make any difference whether there's an advantage or disadvantage given to him by the market. So a common estimate of the just price couldn't refer indiscriminately to whatever price might be obtainable under market conditions, but what price can sustain both parties in relative security. Now, in the Middle Byzantine period, really the height of the empire, the concept, the prevailing idea was that there was a legitimate profit for a merchant, profit conceived, though, as a wage for his labor and recompense for any risk that he ran in the exercise of this trade. We start using the word merchant far too loosely, we end up mixing up the legitimate role that they might have, however limited it should be, and the normal bourgeois modern conception of the merchant, or someone who has absolutely no moral ties with anything except his own well-being. And that well-being is defined in financial terms. Profiteering is the ability to take advantage of the misfortunes of others or even the decay of society. So you have a famine situation, people jack up the price of grain. You have it with the price of gas over the last 10 years. Buying land for pennies on the dollar due to debts from usury, whatever, were automatically unlawful. The concept of stockpiling, which the merchant class would do as long as there's been a merchant class, hoarding different types of food and commodities, with the view of controlling supply and thus acquiring unreasonable profit. That was the case in diamonds, for example. And into the 11th century, this was the basic Byzantine idea. And it never quite went away, but whether or not it could be enforced is a different story. The just profit, though, opposed to this, isn't so much what the merchant can gain in so-called free negotiation, but these non-economic constraints and regulations. There's a canon of Patriarch Nikephoros I, who died in 815, that states the just profit is roughly 10%. But that's a very general estimation. I do think he's referring to seafarers. The book, the administrative book, the Book of the Eparch, around the same era, a bit later, you also have a list of the rates of profit, in this case, legislated by the state. They include butchers and fishermen, bakers, grocers, even the price of wine, something that's established between the owners of the tavern and the eparch, which is proportionate to the purchase price. So while the rates of profit permitted to the guilds in the Book of the Eparch, they vary, but the principle is clear, though. Maximizing profits by taking full advantage of the forces of supply and demand is not permitted, for the simple reason that it will destroy the society that institutionalizes it. Short-term gain by the oligarchic class means the long-term misery of everybody else. And the system that has made you wealthy will eventually fall apart. There's a regulation. I mean, the Book of the Eparch is essentially a legal document. But it's very important. There is the concept of the regulation of profits. The only way that merchants then could increase its income is by increasing value. Increasing volume. Not by taking advantage of bad times. So the just profit, whether it be 10% or not, of course it has a value independent of the mechanism of bargaining. But whenever the state grows weaker, the late 11th century, beginning of the 12th, there are indications that free negotiation is slowly gaining ground. This can only happen as the wealthy assert themselves. The more freedom and economic exchange, the less important the non-economic and moral view of the just profit was found. And this is around the time where the Italians were slowly monopolizing Byzantine trade. That's mostly after 1204, but it became one of the biggest problems in Byzantine line. So the concept of just profit was not something spoken of a lot, because a lot of it was simply taken for granted. But certainly there's nothing you can find that talks about supply and demand as the primary, if not only, mechanism of coming up with prices. And the Book of the Eparch kind of laid out the very general guidelines here. In the early 14th century, for example, right in the city of Constantinople, given the severe circumstances, you know, the last couple generations of the empire, there was a famine, and the patriarch confronted the emperor and said that there is a just price and a just rate of profit, and of course he requests state intervention, because merchants were stockpiling grain, and bakers and this was creating extravagant profits. It's in times of great suffering where these issues become very important. Now, there's a claim that Byzantium was the only society at the time, either Islamic or Western, that permitted, quote, lending and interest. Now, the rates were regulated and they were never compounded. But it's really easy, especially for scholars who don't deal with this stuff all the time, to confuse interest as a charge on the profitability of an enterprise and interest charged on itself. Of course, there's always going to be suspicion of this. Since Constantine I, there was the attempt to regulate this in accordance with both the economic principles, especially concerning seafarers and these sea loans, and of course non-economic ones, such as the status of the lender or the borrower in society. There was a claim that the canons, even the Old Testament, only referred to ecclesiastics, but that wasn't true. But when you read about the justifications for lending an interest, you notice that it has nothing to do with usury. The interest is equivalent to the revenues from the item loaned, which is an economic argument, but that would be just another version of partnership. The novel of Leo VI, Emperor Leo VI, permitted interest. It had been forbidden by, of course, the Great Battle of the First. In fact, there was no one would lend money without charging interest. But, of course, compound interest was banned, not to mention the argument of the risk. But this is a given anyway. Byzantine canonists were convinced that simple loans carry no risk, and therefore there is no interest charged on it. Some argue, of course, that the borrower profits from a loan and the interest is the lender's share of profits. Again, that's a productive loan and has nothing to do with usury. One of the things that E. Michael Jones talks about in Barren Metal is that the church, whether it be the Byzantine Empire or in the West and confronting the North Italian, we're going to talk about roughly the same time, they were unclear about what constitutes interest, what constitutes principal, because economic theory hadn't developed. The Medici bankers had gone light years ahead of those who wanted to regulate them. The Medici Banking House came up with some of the most sophisticated and convoluted bookkeeping methods that the church did not keep up with. And the distinction between, among risk, partnership, and just interest on the money, it seems like a minor distinction, but it's not. The assumption always was that usury, and you could call profit interest if you want, and that's where it gets complicated. But universally, it was that usury was a contravention of divine law. But usury and lending an interest, if that interest is in fact nothing more than profit, they're obviously not the same thing. After the first phase of iconoclasm, where the Patriarch Tarasios and Nikephoros I condemned usury for anybody, and that was adopted in the civil legislation by Basil I, but in the 1340s, this is a time of great tension and instability. It had to be stamped out one more time. And this is connected, of course, with things like the Just Price and the resurgence of these debates in the 14th century. This is always at times of crisis. The point being that rough times bring out the usurers. And if they're left unchecked, the capital of the entire society will be in their hands. Lending an interest, if that interest is based on the performance of the enterprise, is not usury. In fact, you shouldn't call it interest. That's a partnership in that case. And that's what we're talking about here, not money being its own increase. It was only when the state weakened that became usury. But the shocking level of stability, interest rates remained stable from Justinian right until the Fourth Crusade. In the early 9th century, there was a small increase of 12 to 16.7%, but of course there was never any compounding. And the same thing for food prices. From the 9th, 10th, 11th, right up to the 4th Crusade, before the Italian usurers took over, food prices remained the same for centuries and centuries. Same thing for land prices. Right up until the 4th Crusade, one of the results of the 4th Crusade was the dominance of Italians in the economy. Those from, especially from Venice, but Florence as well. And they tended to hate each other. But this stability, it comes from the imperial focus on labor, their constant attacks on oligarchy and usury, the state's tight control of the currency, and because the empire was seen as this eternal universe that can never be conquered, there was a huge deal of faith in it. Byzantine coins have been found in China the same period of time. The merchant mind invaded from the Fourth Crusade on from Venice. But the extreme stability, which is one of the great legacies of Byzantium, has a lot to do with state actions against the creditor class. So after the death of Basil II, the oligarchy reasserted itself. If they're suppressed for a while, they wait in the shadows until the proper time. The minute the state weakens, the minute the emperor weakens or becomes, you know, non-existent, the oligarchs come out of the closet. So let's be clear. Interest is justified when the creditor becomes a partner in the enterprise. But that's not really interest. That's just another word for profit. Usury is when it's charged on the money as such. Even if you went bankrupt and you buried the money in the backyard, charging interest on that doesn't make any sense. That would be usury, especially when you're talking about economic inequality, such that usury is the only way that people can function. People can work, and we see this with the payday loans today, and their interest rate is, I think, 2,400%, which is another way of saying people who borrow from them out of sheer desperation are going to stay that way. Stay in debt for a very long time. So capital function no differently than any other economic activity. It all comes under justice and hence the common good. Prices of these things became standard and expected. There was a little bit of fluctuation at the margins, but that's it. The success of the state and bureaucracy showed few changes from year to year. And of course, at the Fourth Crusade and afterwards, that's when these constraints became less and less powerful. And then the Italians took over. Even the Fourth Crusade itself, financed by Italian usurers. So, I didn't get a chance to get into people like Gemistos Plethon. I'm not sure if I'm going to continue this next week. But as always, I got through like half of everything I was going to deal with today. But maybe I'll continue this next week. But either way, I will talk to you later. Bye-bye.